hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In studio with me today, live in the flesh, is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And if you'd like to call in with your question or comment or send us an email, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495 or email is zestygarden@gmail.com. Dan?
Wow, what a year.
Here you are again.
Yeah, it's just like I thought I was had a little bit more time. And then the next thing you know, February is here. It's 55 degrees outside. I got my golf clubs out, and I'm going to go golfing, I think, on the weekend because the course is open in town. You know, I'm expecting to be up skiing and doing that type of stuff, and now I'm thinking about getting my garden going. It's just like crazy. Well, what's happening?
Let's talk about the weather a little bit. So I don't know how much it affects vegetables and so forth, but I'm a little worried about my fruit trees because things are starting to bud. I was pruning last Saturday and just going, ugh.
Yeah.
I hope we don't get a cold snap.
Well, you know, I've taken that approach, and Dr. Black and I were sitting and talking about it, and we actually had someone from the Salt Lake Tribune come up and call us and say, hey, what's happening and how this is going to affect the fruit industry and the fruit crops and fruit trees and that type of thing. And, you know, I think we're of the mind right now we're okay. You know, sure, it's warm. Buds are starting to swell. They're getting a little plumper maybe than we would like them to be for February. If it would just cool off a little bit, we'd be okay. But they're talking record temperatures over the weekend, and you know, that's a bad thing. And certainly then if this progresses for another couple of weeks and then bad things turn about in late February or March, where, you know, it can come in like a lamb and go out like a lion. Well, that's what February's doing. You know, it could be nasty, and it could really impact, you know, what's going on with your fruit tree. So I was driving through on Monday afternoon. My wife and I had been to a family event back east and got caught in the blizzard there and weren't able to get out. So we spent 24 hours in the airport, essentially, because of the conditions that they're having. And it seems like all the storms are just floating over us this year. And we're warm and unseasonably different than what we normally would expect, and it doesn't hurt our vegetable crops in any way. I mean, you know, the asparagus isn't going to be popping up. The soil temperatures are still much too cold for that to occur. But, you know, you start thinking about, well, let's get the garden going, and normally we sit in February thinking about our seed catalogs and looking at stuff and kind of doing some planning. And so, I mean, this is the normal time for us to plan. But it might be a time for us to even start to plant some things if the soil would be dry enough for us to maybe get in and do that stuff. And one of the things we talked about last fall was, yeah, you know, get some of those beds prepped, get them ready so that if the conditions are right in the spring, we can do that.
Well, I know, and we've talked about this before, about 10 years ago, I planted peas the third week of February. And they were the best peas I've ever had.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we look at things, you know, I've got a planter box that's up on the south side of my house, and I overwintered some lettuce and some spinach in that, and I've got some open areas in it, and so it's drying out nicely. That little bit of rain that we had, you know, made the surface a little bit moist, but, you know, it was dug over basically and ready to go. And so, you know, if the weather's right this weekend, I'm going to kind of rake it off a little bit, and I'm going to sow some more spinach, and I'm going to sow some lettuce and do some of those kinds of crops in there. Because it's just so nice. And then I may even, you know, kind of put a glass sheet over top of it so that I kind of create the greenhouse effect and try and get those things going earlier. And that is going to mean my garden just gets started that much quicker. So, you know, and if you had a high tunnel or even some low tunnels, you know, some smaller structures that you kind of have and you normally build, you know, this is a perfect kind of weather to stick those things together and put them up and get them started and get those seeds in there and get them going, or to put some plants in if you have some plants ready for it. Because, you know, we are moving into the time when the sun is getting warmer. You can tell that in February already. And by the end of this month, these plants just want to go. And all they need is really a little bit of temperature. And that's what you're going to provide if you have a low tunnel or a high tunnel that's, you know, in the yard. And you can really, really get some production out of it.
My indicator that things are warming up and the days are getting longer, other than the calendar, is I'm getting more eggs for my chickens.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's exactly right. You know, you see those kinds of things happening, and, you know, everything starts responding to the lengthening days, and we all feel a little bit better after the dreariness of December and January, and certainly... you know, you just see the sky is brighter and the sun angles are higher and all of those things that say, hey, it's time for us to start thinking about another garden season.
So the high tunnels that you have up here at the university,
This
warmer weather, how does that affect?
Well,
other than it just speeds things along, maybe they don't slow down as much as they would have.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting with high tunnels. I was down for some meetings in St. George and in Cedar City, and they had some gardening workshops that I was involved in down there, and there were several individuals in the audience that had high tunnels, and in that southern area, they just said that, you know, they are almost producing too much for their family. They're not supporting their own family. They said they're supporting neighbors now and, you know, siblings and children and things like that because of the amount of produce that's coming out of these structures. And particularly this one couple in Cedar City said that it was just, you know, phenomenal how much they got for nothing. I mean, essentially, it was the cost of putting up the structure, and now they've had it for a few years, and they've kind of learned the ins and outs of functioning that structure, and they said that, boy, they're overwintering lettuce and spinach and greens and various kinds of onion and you name it, and having more production than they can even imagine, and eating so much better, they say, because it's fresh and it's grown by them and it tastes so much better and it's not been sitting around. And so we know that can happen here, even up in the north, and we've done it here. And so, yeah, you get these warmer temperatures. The biggest struggle that you have is that you don't think you normally need to ventilate these structures in the middle of the winter because the calendar suggests that it's supposed to be, you know, going up to about 30 during the day and, you know, down to 20 at night type of thing. And so you're fine if you just leave them closed up. But boy, when it's 50 out, yeah, you probably have to start opening the structure up a little bit and letting some air in there because it's just too hot.
Is this, what are your gardening aphorisms that says when you have an enclosed structure that the air, it's 30 degrees warmer than the air temperature outside? Does this work the same with
that's
the high tunnels?
That's exactly the principle that we based it off of because we've got the data to show that it is 30 degrees warmer. So on a 30 degree day in February when the sun is shining, it's 50 degrees inside that structure. And, you know, plants like to grow at 50 degrees. That's what lettuce likes. That's what spinach likes. That's what, you know, all the greens like. That's what young onions plants like. You know, all of those things that we want to grow and put in a salad or use somehow in our cooking and food prep is possible in these types of structures. And you can kind of, you know, get away from having, you know, to deal with the food fluctuation prices that you see in the grocery store that are impacted by climatic conditions someplace in the United States or in the western half of the U.S. and Mexico. And you don't need to rely on that much anymore.
So how do you know when you should be getting into the soil? I would be worried about soil compaction and it don't want it to be too wet. How do you know when the soil's ready to work?
Well, you know, that's why I always emphasize to the listeners, think about doing some things in the fall. You're putting the garden to bed, you know, so, you know, what do? Some people just kind of walk away from it. And then next spring they have to come out and they have to remove tomato cages. They have to pull stakes out. They have to, you know, clean things up. They have to
till the leaves in
and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, those are activities that you can do in the spring. But if there are some of those that you could do in the fall, which we had such a phenomenal fall as well, that, you know, most of that prep work should have been done back then. Then what you have is you actually have sections in your garden that are just kind of sitting there waiting for you to do some early things with. And if that soil has been tilled, maybe slightly raised so that it can drain a little bit freely, then as we get these warm, bright, sunny days, it's easy for you to go in there with a rake, quickly just rake off a section and sow lettuce or sow spinach or sow, you know, some of these cool weather crops that are appropriately to be planted early, or get your early pea in, as you say. And that then allows those plants to start. Now, sure, the soils are still a little on the cool side, but they will sprout. And not only that, they start to mature before the heat of summer comes. Because if you wait to do all of these things to the end of April, and it turns really hot in May, which is not an uncommon thing to have happen, then the quality of the product that you're getting out of your garden isn't really that good anyway. So why not think about trying to get these things done a little bit earlier? And then your next question was, well, how do you know whether it's right to do this or not? I recommend that you just have kind of a dedicated garden thermometer. You know, you can buy the instant digital types. You can go in and poke that into the soil, same type that you would use to cook with and measure water temperature or measure the temperature of a roast or whatever. And you just put that in at the planting depth that or the seeding depth that you're going to put your particular crop in. Maybe a half an inch into the soil.
I was going to say, it's not going to be very deep.
It's not very deep, and you'll be surprised at how warm it is because the dark surface of the soil heats up quite quickly, and the moisture is there. And so, yeah, it fluctuates a lot over the course of the day, but you're really kind of looking for, well, what's the temperature that's occurring about noon or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, somewhere in that time frame. And how warm does it get? And if it's getting temperatures there above 50 degrees, all of our cool season vegetables could be planted into those kind of conditions. So you could plant carrot, you could plant radish, you could plant spinach, or you could plant lettuce or onion or, and, you know, just go down the list and start thinking of all those vegetables that can have an early start. Now, they don't germinate very fast because the temperature at night is cooling down to, you know, close to whatever the ambient temperature is, but it's enough that the seed will imbibe. It'll start to use the reserves that are in that seed and progress through the germination process. And instead of germinating really, really quickly, it's going to take a little bit longer, but it's still going to give those plants a much, much better start. And then they're going to grow when the temperatures are getting better as well.
I know just from past experience, like with the peas, if I wait until April to put peas in, well, my germination is not very good. Plus, the plants are shorter, and I just don't get as good quality. But those that I planted in March or the end of February, like that one time, almost every single one of those seeds germinated.
Yeah.
It took them almost 2 weeks to germinate when it was in February, but
that's
I don't
okay.
care.
That's fine. And another way you can get around the problem is, well, you have your seed bed prepped anyway. The moisture is there. So one of the things you could do is take a sheet of clear plastic and lay that over top of your bed. That way, if it does, the moisture that's underneath there, if you think about what happens when you boil water on the stove, you put a lid on it. If you have a glass lid like my wife's pots and pans, you see the water beginning to rise up and then it collects on that glass surface. Well, a plastic sheet over top of your planting bed will do exactly the same thing. The sun will pass through that. It'll heat it up. Some of that moisture evaporates. That actually pulls the moisture up toward the top of the bed, and it keeps it nice and moist. Plus, it also makes it that much warmer so that you can get through these colder nights and the seeds will actually germinate faster. And so that's a simple, simple way to actually get things started at a time of the year when we know it's a little bit on the cold side. So you have your bed prepped, you put your seeds in, you lay some plastic over the top of it, anchor it down so it doesn't blow away when the wind comes, and, you know, just watch the plant start to grow. As soon as you start to see seedlings coming up underneath the plastic, you may want to lift it up a little bit, you know, so, you know, kind of create a little tunnel rather than just a flat sheet on the soil. And now you have a little greenhouse effect. And the net effect is you're just going to get that crop that much earlier. And this is a perfect time to really start doing it when we have such perfect weather out.
And while we're talking about seeds and planting, there's another one of your aphorisms that you do not plant the seed any deeper than three times the thickness of the seed as it lies in your hand.
You must have gone and studied the
Dan,
the,
I've got the, this posted in my office. Oh, it's right there next to my computer.
Okay. Yeah, well, and that's a good one. You know, you want to get the seed in the right depth. That's exactly right. And it's so critical that oftentimes we plant seeds much, much too deep or too shallow, and the net effect of that is they don't really perform that well. And so we say it's not growing, you know, and it's not the seed's fault. It's usually the operator error, I call it, and you've planted it too deep or too shallow. So work at trying to the 3X rule that we call, that one that you cited, three times the thickness of the seed as it lays in the palm of your hand. Naturally, that's the way it's, that's where you want to place it. And so most of our small seeded stuff, that's why we say measure the temperature at about a half an inch deep in the soil for those small seeded things like a carrot seed or a lettuce
seed. Not very thick.
Oh, it's very skinny. But it's hard to take the soil temperature at that appropriate depth. Yeah. So we say a half an inch. And if you're planting large seeds like your peas, you might be planting those at, you know, a half an inch to 3/4 of an inch deep. Then, you know, take your temperature at about 1 inch deep. And then when the temperature is right there, then you can get them in. And then you're going to be well on your way to getting the kinds of plants that you want. So simple little things can get you started really, really nicely. And certainly down in the South, if you're in St. George, you should be doing all of these things right now. You should have your garden up and going. Cedar City, you know, is more like us here, but they are usually more open than we are. Mm-hmm. The snow doesn't come as often, and it melts a little faster. If it does come, you know, there's already gardeners down there starting to think about it. And then along the Wasatch Front, normally we would say, yeah, the end of February, early March is when you want to start doing these. But if the weather is cooperating as it is this year, start a little early. Don't wait to the normal time, because even if we do get some cold temperatures and those seeds are still sprouting or they've come up already, usually most of these cold weather crops are very, very tolerant to some cold temperatures that they're going to get. And we're not going to be excessively cold. It's kind of unlikely that we're going to have the bitter, bitter, frigid type weather that we would expect.
Well, and what I always get concerned about, I think 30 years ago on February 1st, was the coldest recorded temperature in Utah and I think the lower 48 states. It was up at, was it Middle Sink or Peter Sink up Logan Canyon?
Right.
That was only a couple of days ago, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the climate is changing. It's warming up a little bit. We're seeing this warming in the winter just a little more often than we've used to been seeing it. So I hope it doesn't get that cold again.
No, and you know, you could speculate about that. I'm not worried about it. What I'm more worried about, if we think about our fruit trees and things like that, because I got peach trees in my yard, I've got apricot trees in my yard, and apricot blooms early, buds are starting to swell. And then if we would get, you know, temperatures that would go down to 15 or something like that, and you get past a certain stage of flower bud development, even if it's still in the bud, that's when the damage occurs. Mm. And so then you start losing bloom. Now, for a plant like apricot, which flowers profusely and doesn't set all of its blooms anyway, you know, that natural thinning might be beneficial to me. So I'm kind of sitting back and I'm watching as we were driving through Brigham City and looking on the fruitway. Yeah, there's a lot of growers over there that are pruning their orchards already. And I've always been one to kind of wait a little bit longer simply because I don't kind of know what the temperature is going to do. And my little microclimate that's where I live is one that, you know, it does bloom earlier than other places in the valley. And so I've got to kind of always watch it if I want to make sure that I get fruit on my peach.
So you're saying you don't want to prune your fruit out before?
Yeah, I don't want to thin it out too much, because then if I do lose some, then I might be actually light on my load. I'd rather have a more normal fruit load, and so I can't tend to be one that waits a little bit. And you can do that if you only have a few trees. Now if I was a big orchardist, I wouldn't do that. I'd have to go in, because it takes a certain amount of time to prune 10 or 15 or 20 acres of fruit trees. And you can't just wait until the last minute to do some of those types of jobs. And so they're out there right now, and they're all saying, well, you know, it's nice. We just don't like it being so warm. We wish it was 10 degrees cooler, because then those buds don't swell as rapidly and the plant doesn't progress as far. And we would be a little bit more, sleep a little bit better at night, because we do not know what tomorrow will bring. And we don't know what the temperature is going to be like, and we just don't know how cold it could get yet between now and the end of March, when, you know, it's still classified as winter.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is in studio as my guest, and we'd love to have your questions or comment. 1-800-826-1495. Or send us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. We're talking about gardening, and Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He's in studio for about another 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-826-1495. Or zestygarden@gmail.com. So, Dan, let's move to St. George.
Let's do that.
Literally and figuratively.
I'd be
okay until along about the end of May, and then I'd want to move back. So,
well, I was thinking that, you know, I should go down and try and find a condo or something like that to own, and basically go down there. December would be nice, and January and February and March. And by April, you know.
Are we getting older?
I think we're getting older. You know, and get away a little bit from the colder stuff. It's still, you know, supposed to be only like in the mid-50s to upper 50s down there, and yet, you know, they're talking 70. So, yeah, those our friends in the South, you know, have it nice at times of the year, but come, you know, June and July and August, when you're cracking 100 and we're sitting at 90, I'd rather be here. So, you know, we got to kind of figure out how we're going to do this. And yet, you know, our gardeners down there really have it really nice in the winter, because they can, as I referenced in the first half, is they can do things in the winter that you can't really do up here in terms of even having stuff just out in the garden. If they did a little bit of protection for it so that they avoided those plants being exposed to the cold nights that they get, because they do freeze, but it's not hard freezes. You know, that's, you know, 30, 28, you know, anybody can kind of put up with that kind of stuff. And the plants actually can put up with it quite nicely. So they should be planting peas now down in Kanab and in St. George, and, you know, certainly even maybe over in Moab and those areas, the temperatures are warming up enough. Get your peas in, get your spinach in, get your lettuce in, sow those early carrots, you know, start some onion from seeds so that you have bulb onions later on in the year. Don't transplant onions yet. It's still too early for that, because the cold weather that they'll get when you transplant will actually cause the meristem, or the growing point in the plant, to revert from a vegetative bud to a reproductive bud. And so if we transplant things like onion too early, the impact of that is going to be flower stalks. And so we really don't want those kind of things to go in. And then certainly if you have plants that you've already started, you know, you might want to, with cabbage and broccoli and some of those kinds of plants that you would transplant, probably wait until about the first week of March to get those out into the vegetable garden. It's a little too early. And if we do get some really cold weather, you know, and the nights drop down to 25 or something, that's really hard on those plants. They just don't really like those cold, cold nights that you're going to get, unless you can protect them somehow. You know, you can put them under a low tunnel or put them on plastic and then have a tunnel over top of them so that you're creating a microclimate around the plant that's much, much more favorable for their growth. So there's a lot of things that our St. George and Kanab and even some of our Moab listeners can start to do. And then as we start moving farther north in the state, you know, you get up into Fillmore and you get up into Beaver and into the Salt Lake Valley region. You know, normally we would start planting a lot of our seeded stuff, peas and spinach and that type of stuff. We'd start seeding those into the vegetable garden toward the end of this month or the early part of March. But you might want to take advantage, as we said, of the conditions that we have this year, which are favorable for it, provided you can get into your garden area and work it without kind of screwing up the soil structure. Because if it's a little wet, we've had a little bit of rain, not a lot, but, you know, you can't really probably go out there with a tiller and till because the subsoil is too wet. And so that's why I always say prep a small area in the spring or in the fall so that you have it in the spring. And those are a lot of things that you can start to do. The other thing that you can do is start thinking about, okay, what am I going to get ready for transplanting out into my garden if I haven't already done that? Historically, we would say that the normal time to start seeding broccoli for transplants, if we're growing them ourselves in the house to put out into our garden, would be somewhere around the first of February. And the reason we kind of say that date is because it takes about 8 weeks to grow a broccoli plant or a cabbage plant from the time you sow it in the tray until you maybe would transplant it out into the vegetable garden. And if we do a quick think about the calendar, that means we would start planting out into our vegetable garden, things like cabbage and broccoli, somewhere around the first 2 weeks of April. And that would be about, we'd have to start now in order to achieve that time frame. And so there's lots of things that you actually can do to get plants started. Don't go out and buy them and transplant them now. It seems like it's warm enough, but believe me, they don't like that. It's still too cold, even though it's been warm.
Can you seed coal crops directly?
You can.
In the soil, will that work?
Yes, and you could do that right now as well and grow either the plants right in the garden. They're going to germinate slowly. They're going to grow slowly if they do come up. They're going to be a little bit harder to work with that way because you're going to have to move them at some time or you're going to have to thin them out. But it's a possibility to just sow them directly into the vegetable garden. So mustard greens, you might think of as a brassica. Kale, if you have some early spring kale or if you've run out of your overwintering stuff, you know, those would be good ones to actually start to seed at this time of the year, as well as those other ones that we've discussed.
If you decide to germinate them indoors, what sorts of temperatures do they need? I mean, because if I'm putting them outside right now, the soil's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing they don't want to be too warm in the
home.
No,
your normal house temperature, you know, they germinate best at around 65 to 70 degrees, and that's kind of where we're keeping our houses at this point. The bigger thing that you have to be thinking about when you're growing your own transplants is that you create an environment that has enough light for them. And you need to either have a light table or something like that where you can actually brighten up the conditions around the plants more, because trying to grow them in a window or something like that, you really don't grow the best quality plants. They tend to be a little bit stretched out or leggy, we call that. They're etiolated. They aren't stiff-stemmed. They're kind of floppy. You know, just poor quality because oftentimes they're just searching for light and there's not enough. So we do on the Extension webpage, if you go to extension.usu.edu and then search for the publication on growing transplants, there is one that's specifically for how to grow transplants in your own home. And the key thing is there's a nice table in there. It tells you about how many weeks it takes to grow a transplant to the right size. So with the brassicas, we often say 6 to 8 weeks. And that kind of depends on temperature. It depends on light levels. It depends on how well you do feeding and watering the plants. And that publication gives you really detailed stuff about that. Now, what about tomato and growing peppers and things like that? Normally, we would say wait to start your pepper plants or your tomato plants until about the first week of March, because it also takes 6 to 8 weeks. And if your normal transplant time into the vegetable garden is somewhere in early May, you want to not have those plants ready too early, unless you're thinking about growing a really, really big plant in a big pot that you're going to try and get some early tomatoes on, or if you already own a tunnel or have built a tunnel and you're going to put those things out, because normally we would say plant your tomatoes in your high tunnel somewhere around the middle of April or early April. So you should have started those already if you've got a tunnel and you need plants ready for that. Most of our nurseries and garden centers aren't really starting those plants until later in this month so that they have them ready for the normal gardening season in the north, which would be in early to mid May. If you're down in St. George, it would be a month earlier. So you would start to see tomatoes showing up here in the nurseries and garden centers in St. George and in Kanab, probably sometime around the end of this month or the early part of next month. And even then, you know, it's a little bit early for sticking those out unless you're protecting them somehow with a wall of water or a low tunnel or a high tunnel or up against the south-facing side of your home where you can give them some protection on some of those nights where it's a little bit questionable from a temperatures perspective.
Well, we have an email question from Sevier County. We have Jeanette. And she says, can you give us a supplier for high tunnels? Can we use frost cloth instead of clear plastic to warm the soil and protect plants? Obviously, Sevier in Wayne County isn't in Utah. I'm not quite sure what that – maybe something else is missing. But yeah. Anyway, so can you use the frost cloth instead of clear plastic to warm the soil?
Yeah, no. I don't recommend you put the frost cloth on to warm soil because what it is, it's a white surface. It tends to reflect a lot of the heat. And actually, when we look at soil temperatures under frost cloth, it's about the same as the ambient temperature is. And sometimes it actually is cooler. We tried a few years ago to do some work where we were looking at laying these cloths on the soil surface to speed up bean seed germination earlier in the spring when it's kind of cold. And we found that bean seed germination was low underneath the frost cloth because the temperature stayed too cold. So clear plastic would be a much, much better choice. And, you know, you can for short periods of time, you can use, you know, just the cheap grade contractor's grade plastic that you would purchase at, you know, a home supply store or a home improvement store. You can buy those sheets. They'll do the job that you want. Really, all you're trying to do is to let radiation through it so that it can heat it up and then it doesn't escape back to the air. Now, where to get tunnels or to build tunnels, we do have a design for a high tunnel on our website that is easy to build and it's made out of product that's locally available. If you want to buy a pre-manufactured type, you're going to have to order that in from someplace, and there are literally hundreds of places that you can order them from, and they vary in price from a small amount of money, maybe $1,000 up to $10,000, depending on how big you want the structure to be. And the design that we've put together is one that is you're able to build in almost any length that you want it to be. It's And it's very simple to do, and the design is right there, and that's a good place to start. And it's reasonably robust as well.
I am not a carpenter. I don't do well with putting things together, but I attended a workshop that you did a couple years ago, and I was amazed at how easy it was to put this thing together, enough so that I thought, I can do this.
Yeah, and I think there's usually someone in each family that, you know, you may not have the skills, but a brother or a sister, I'll not be too sexist today. There are people that have those skills around, and there's always somebody that likes to play with this stuff. And if you had
my dad come over, he'll love to do this.
They would love to do that. So if you don't think you can do it, but really we designed it in a way that anyone can do it. And we've had a lot of workshops over the years on how to build these things. And there have been people that have come that said they're not very handy, and once they see how it goes together, but even if they saw the plans, they said the plans were simple enough that they could follow the directions and do that. So that's a good place to start if you want to build one of these structures. And I like them simply because if you're in Sevier or Wayne County, believe me, I know the climate and how difficult it is to grow things around the clock and around the year, and that, and your growing season is really short. It will allow you to have produce pretty much any month of the year. You know, certainly you're going to be able to have tomatoes in the summer, and, you know, you could have a lot of greens through most of the winter. You may not have them in the dead of winter, but, you know, starting again right now, that's what we're gearing up to start planting in our tunnels this month. And you know, we should have been doing it in January, but we had other things we were doing. And so it's one of those kind of nice additions to a backyard that, you know, makes the garden even that much more enjoyable for you.
So we've got 3 minutes left. How much have you grown celery?
How much have I grown celery? Well, I grew up in a celery patch when I was a boy.
Okay.
And I decided that I had enough of it back then. It's one of those, I was working with our student organic farm this past year, and they decided to grow celery, and they really realized quite quickly how difficult celery is to grow. It's slow. It takes a very rich soil. So if you've had an area in your garden that has lots of compost in it, or you're capable of adding lots of nutrients to it and create a soil that is more organic-like rather than mineral-like, which is what most of our soils are, then that's a good place. The other thing that they learned quite quickly was that you need to actually pack the plants together really tightly in order to have the plant stretch up. Otherwise, it tends to stay very open, and the petioles are laying more flat-like rather than upright-like, which when we go to the grocery store and you buy a celery stalk, notice the stalks are all standing up straight. That's because the commercial farms pack these plants very, very closely together, and they didn't quite follow my instructions as well as I would like them to. And so while the quality was okay, the plants were pretty small, and then they kind of didn't get the watering quite right. And so they were a little stringy, though the flavor was actually quite nice. So we grew a lot of celery in Utah in the past. It's possible to do it. It's just pack the plants close together, feed them a lot, water them more than you ever imagine relative to the rest of your garden, because they are very, very high water users. And then expect them, and they take a long time. So there is a fact sheet on our extension website about growing celery and
how they need to be started right now.
Yeah, last month.
You know, so
because
that
they take 10 to 12 weeks to grow plants, and so you want to plant them out in early April up north here.
I know they took forever to germinate indoors.
Right. So you know, you really need to start them in January. So we're a little late on it, but you may be able to find transplants someplace too a little later in the year.
Okay. Dan, thanks for coming
Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he'll be on the first Thursday of every month, so stay tuned. Coming up next is Petals and Pros, and there's a couple of great recipes, one for mushroom soup and the other one is for squash apple soup. So stay tuned.
Good morning. This is Nancy Williams, and I'm going to share with you today an essay from one of my favorite authors, Ruth Reichel, who is the author of Tender at the Bone, a book of memoirs, stories about food writing, but she was for a long time the editor of Gourmet magazine. This essay comes from Comfort Me with Apples, which is her 2001 New York Times bestseller that was named a USA Today best book of 2001. She's a very warm, funny writer, and she's still writing about food here, but she's talking about fall and winter in New York and how she gets through it. And of course, being a food writer, that is with food. So this particular essay contains two recipes, one of which I've tried, one of which I haven't, and both of which are probably yummy because I've never made any of her recipes that weren't yummy. Anyway, so this comes from Comfort Me with Apples, More Adventures at the Table by Ruth Reichel. She writes, "That fall in New York, I made mushroom soup almost every night for my mother and for myself. It's the most soothing soup I know, with no sharp edges to jar the palate, no sneaky unexpected spices. It's the perfect prescription for those in need of solace, and we were definitely in need of that. Mom was running out of money, and the only solution was to sell her country house. I went east to help her clean it out. But she soon found this so depressing that she washed her hands of the entire project and took to her bed. It's too much for an old lady, she protested, refusing to leave the apartment. You and Doug are breaking up and I'm losing my house. You'll have to do it all alone. I took the train to South Norwalk every day, walking from the station to the house. I hauled boxes from the attic, cleared closets, dismantled beds and bookcases. The Goodwill truck arrived every afternoon to collect another room full of furniture. In my parents' bedroom, I emptied the dresser drawers, caressing the soft cotton pajamas that had belonged to my father. I found a pair of shorts I remembered Mom wearing when I was in kindergarten, and the halter top she had paired with it. I unearthed the dress she wore to my wedding. Bit by bit, my parents' bedroom disappeared, and I moved into the bathroom, where I swept old lipsticks, bobby pins, and compacts into a box. Then I moved into my bedroom, reducing it to another blank space. In the living room, I took down the paintings, rolled up the rugs, pushed the teak coffee table from Copenhagen into the middle of the floor. I boxed up the silver in the dining room, picked up the books in the den. Day by day, the house grew emptier. Even its smell began to change. Every night I went back to New York and made mushroom soup. Then I went out to walk the windswept sidewalks, trying to tire myself enough so I could sleep. But I could not keep from seeing the city through Doug's eyes, noticing the arc of a curb, the reflection of a traffic light, the way electrical lines went singing through the streets. I had made a terrible mistake. When I was so exhausted that I could not stumble down another block, I turned and headed home for bed. Doug called, my mother said one night when I walked in the door. He's in New York. He's on his way over. It was painful to see Doug in my mother's apartment, surrounded by all my father's books. It was such a reminder of what we had once had, what we had lost, that we clung to each other, entwining our hands as if we'd never let go. In the morning, my mother was furious. "People don't behave this way," she cried when he had left. "He's leading you on." And then she looked at me and added, "I've never seen you so miserable. He's in love with someone else, and now he's leaving you." It was easier to be angry at my mother than myself, and I spent the day in the attic, viciously throwing out things I knew she would want. Old curtains, ugly linens, an atrocious table she had always inexplicably loved. It gave me a certain satisfaction. When Goodwill rang the doorbell for their daily pickout, I sang out, "Come in!" But it wasn't Goodwill. "I drove out to see you," said Doug. "There's a full moon, and I thought maybe we could go to the pier for dinner, just for old time's sake." We had stuffed shrimp and lobster and key lime pie. We talked about my father and had too many drinks. And then we went back to the empty house and pulled a mattress off the Goodwill pile and put it in the middle of the living room floor. The moon was shining in the window. turning the wooden floor into a sea of silver. We snuggled together on the mattress, sailing on a vast, shimmering ocean of light. But sometime during the night, after the moon had set, I felt Doug jerk and come awake. It was pitch dark. "What's wrong?" I asked. "I had the strangest dream," he said. "I was holding a power tool, and it exploded in my hands." I woke up knowing that it was really over. I made coffee and toast in the empty kitchen. Goodwill had already picked up all the pots. We sat on the floor in the dining room and wrapped our hands around the two cups I'd saved for the very end. "There will never be a day when we won't miss each other," I said, savoring the melodrama of the moment. He drove me to the train station, and we stood there on the platform, like in all the movies, waiting for the train to pull in. "It's too good," he replied. "We have to save it." "A week from now," I replied, "you won't feel that way." The train arrived. I climbed on. I was going back to town, going to make mushroom soup. Here's her recipe for mushroom soup. Really simple. 1/2 pound of mushrooms, 1/2 stick or 1/4 cup of butter, 1 small onion diced up, 4 tablespoons flour, 1 cup beef broth, 2 cups half and half, salt and pepper, 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg, and a bay leaf. You thinly slice the mushrooms, melt the butter in a heavy sauté pan, and when the foam subsides, add the onion and sauté until golden. Then add the mushrooms and sauté till brown. Stir in the flour, cook it for about 1 minute, and then slowly add the broth, stirring constantly. Heat the half and half in a saucepan or the microwave. Add it to the mushrooms, along with salt, pepper, nutmeg, and the bay leaf. Cook it over low heat for 10 minutes. Don't boil it. Remove the bay leaf and serve. It serves 4, or probably 2 if you're very hungry. The night that Doug moved out of Channing Way, I made Swiss pumpkin. As I cooked, I reminded myself of a famous Brillat Savarin aphorism. Quote, "The invention of a new recipe does more for mankind than the discovery of a new star." I invented Swiss pumpkin. Watching Doug pack had been unbearable. "You should move out too," he said as he carefully layered his drawings into boxes. "You should get a place of your own. Try living alone for a while, without the safety net of Channing Way." When I didn't reply, he said bitterly, "You're planning on moving right in with Michael, aren't you?" "I don't know what I'm doing," I replied. It was true. Some days I went apartment hunting with Michael. Some days I went apartment hunting alone. Paralyzed by indecisions, I stayed on at Channing Way. Doug had been away so much that if I willed myself not to notice that his belongings were gone, the house did not seem very different. It was the same big mess it had always been, filled with too many people and too few rooms. It was easy to fool myself into thinking that Doug had just gone off on another trip. Then I went to visit his new place. It was just like him. Calm, spare, and quiet. The walls were old brick, the ceiling was high, and Doug had painted the trim a blackened green. The space was uncluttered, with a few beautiful objects strategically placed to capture the eye. I wandered around, touching the things that had once belonged to us both. The stone bird we got in Italy was perched on his kitchen shelf. The star quilt from our bed covered his bed. He'd built himself a small round table for the living room with Charlie Chaplin legs that gave it a human air. It looked like no place we had ever lived together. There were letters on the table in the hall. When I saw that they were addressed to him, it finally sank in. He lived here now. He was home. I had done this. I had pulled my life apart. I would never, ever feel safe again. Doug ground coffee beans and put his arms around me while we waited for the water to boil. "We've done the right thing," he said. "Our relationship has given us the strength to live without each other. We've made each other independent." Words, I thought. So many words. My quiet man was becoming a talker, and I no longer knew if he meant what he said. Now he kissed me and added, "I care more about our relationship than I do about our marriage. That's why I want to let it go." I sighed, turning to leave. As I got to the door, he said, "I think I'll roast a chicken. Can you tell me how to do it?" "Don't worry," I replied. "You'll figure it out." And then I went down the stairs and out the door. I was going home to bake a pumpkin. Here is her recipe for Swiss pumpkin. one pumpkin, about 4.5 pounds, a 14-inch baguette cut into 1/4-inch thick slices and then toasted lightly, 1/4 pound of grated Gruyere cheese, 1 1/4 cups of half and half, 2 large eggs, 1 1/2 teaspoons of kosher salt, 1 teaspoon freshly ground black pepper, and 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Carefully cut a 1-inch slice off the top of the pumpkin. Reserving the top, cut out and discard the seeds and strings. Make 3 layers each of toast and cheese in the pumpkin cavity, alternating layers and ending with cheese. Whisk together the half and half, eggs, salt, pepper, and nutmeg, and slowly pour that mixture into the pumpkin. Replace the top of the pumpkin and bake on a shallow baking pan in the middle of the oven until the pumpkin is tender, about 2 hours. Serve by scooping out the pumpkin flesh with the bread and the cheese. Serves 4. Doesn't that sound marvelous? I might have to go home and make that. It's a kind of a day for that. Anyway, this recipe and this reading has all come from Comfort Me with Apples by Ruth Reichel. I hope you've enjoyed it. The recipes will be online at the Zesty Garden website if you would like to try them. You didn't have to scribble them with a pencil. So there will be recipes for a Swiss pumpkin and the mushroom soup at upr.org on the Zesty Garden tab. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for being with me.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producers Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.